The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Sarah Burr. She joins us on the telephone in Marietta, Ohio. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Vic. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy you're here, too, because we're going to spend the entire program talking about fruit.
That sounds great.
You have a book out called The Fruit Forager's Companion, Ferments, Desserts, Main Dishes, and More from Your Neighborhood and Beyond. How on earth did you decide to write a book like this?
Well, it came together very organically. I would have loved to have a book like this to use once I started foraging in earnest, and there wasn't one, so I wrote one. Unfortunately, as a chef and a writer, I had the tools and the knowledge to do that, but I had become interested in foraging for and cooking with slightly unusual fruits, and I was just frustrated with the lack of reliable recipes and information about how to harvest and store the fruits. So I thought it'd be great to have everything pulled together into one volume.
I'm sure we have a lot of listeners out there who are scratching their heads and saying, well, when I forage for fruit, I go to the produce department. What do you mean by foraging for fruit? Some of them are wondering what you're talking about.
That is a completely fair question. Although I should say, in a strange way, I actually forage for things at the grocery store. My definition of foraging is very broad. So technically, if you're foraging for something, you're going out into the wild and collecting different edible plants. But when I forage, I include gleaning under that definition. And gleaning is gathering completely fine, usable food that would otherwise have gone to waste. So all these lovely ornamental fruit trees that people have in their yards and shrubs, if you go through and you glean apples from their yard with their permission, of course, I still count that as foraging because I think it sounds more fun. But even at the grocery store, if there's ugly produce that's marked down, I always buy that. I just find it a lot more inspirational than the stuff that costs more and is perfect, supposedly.
A number of years ago, I had Ruth Reichel on the program, and she was reminiscing about her days as a dumpster diver. Is that come into your purview as well?
You know what? I've never gone dumpster diving for food, although the Goodwill store, when I was a teenager, had some great clothing in their dumpster. But I do have an affinity, and I think a lot of people do, for things that are free. You know, we have so much available to us as consumers in this world that is really overwhelming. So to have everything narrowed down to being a person who's kind of scrounging for stuff by choice, fortunately, It's more inspirational to me than to have many choices. So I didn't know that about Ruth. That's exciting. You had her on your show, but that makes her even cooler now.
It was her last day as the restaurant critic for the New York Times when I interviewed her. She was just getting ready to go to Gourmet magazine. It was a long time ago. I agree with you, though. When you're going down the road and you see someone's put a pair of beautiful antique stereo speakers out on their curb, it just... You have to pull over and take a look, don't you?
Oh, my goodness, yes. And then put them in your basement and then put them in your yard years on without having ever used them.
In your book, you talk about your young daughter and how you periodically have to clean out extra stuff that she has and get rid of it. And you're amazed by that, considering she's such a young consumer. She doesn't go out and buy this stuff.
No. We don't really buy toys for her. Partially because we're cheap, but partially because they do just seem to kind of show up as gifts from people. You really can't exist as a human in our society without having all these things glom onto you. You have to put in an effort to not have things rather than an effort into acquiring things, which is really just amazing to me. I mean, I love items. I have so many books and records, and they make my days really special. But every now and then I'll think, I would have so much more time if I didn't have to navigate the mental space this occupies, not even the physical space, but the space in my head that managing it occupies. So I have dreams of just jettisoning everything, but I'm certain I'd gather up a bunch of other stuff too, as would my daughter. It just happens.
All right. I think we have some sense of your personal philosophy now, and I would like to mention that here in Yellow Springs, I know of a couple of individuals who cultivate pawpaw trees, and I understand that pawpaws are a big part of this journey of discovery for you.
They are. And, you know, here in Ohio, pawpaws grow in their natural range all over the eastern part of North America, from southeastern Canada all the way down to northern Florida, and as far west as the Mississippi. So they have a pretty broad range. But there's something about Ohio and pawpaws where everything just clicks. And I did grow up here in Ohio, but I didn't even know about pawpaws, which are the largest fruit that's native to North America. So they've been growing here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. I didn't have any idea that they existed. There's a pawpaw tree in the woods in my parents' backyard. It doesn't usually fruit. Mm-hmm. So there was one right back there. I had no idea about them, and I had moved away and read about them somewhere, and I thought, well, how did I miss that? So I got really fixated on finding this thing. It was like the Sasquatch of fruits, because you just don't come across them at a specialty produce market. They're quite fragile once they're ripe. But we ended up moving back to Ohio, and I was on a hike one day, and I saw a pawpaw. Actually, I didn't know what it was, but I saw this fruit splayed in the middle of the trail, just smashed open, and its fruity guts were this gorgeous saffron color, and it had these glossy black seeds, and it was like a fruit from another planet. We're really familiar with the different plants that grow here in Ohio in a lot of ways. They just seem really pat and not that exciting. So to see this thing, and I was just immediately drawn to it. So I took it home, and I deduced that, yes, that truly was one of these pawpaw things. And I kept going back to that spot and picking them. And they taste a little bit like a cross between a mango and a banana with some citrus notes. And they don't taste like anything that you would think would grow here either. So they're just this really, it's like a window to this other dimension in our state that we had no idea about. But that's great to hear that there's a couple that grows them there. So they do grow wild under the right conditions just avidly. But they're quite tricky to cultivate. And I think people who like pawpaws tend to find each other somehow. So that's a special thing.
These people remind me of the people that know where the good morel mushrooms grow and they won't tell anybody. They remind me of those people. My guest is Sarah Burr. Her book is The Fruit Forager's Companion, and it's a beautiful book. It's laid out alphabetically by fruits, and she gives us recipes for each fruit, and she gives us all kinds of information on how to preserve fruits, how to store them, the best ways for each one. You've become quite adept at freezing pawpaw.
Yes. I think that's the best way to preserve it. So I should describe what pawpaws look like briefly for all of your listeners. They're about the size of a small mango, and they're somewhat oval-shaped or egg-shaped. And when they're ripe, they have a greenish-brown skin. That gets a little mottled. They can be quite small too. So if a pawpaw weighs a pound, it's really very large, but they do have that kind of mango shape. And they tend to blend in with the canopy. So they grow on trees that get to be maybe like 20 feet tall or a little taller than that. But pawpaw trees usually aren't that tall. They're understory trees, so you find them out in the woods. And when pawpaws are ripe, which is the late summer, early fall. Usually we'll be gathering them probably out where you guys are up until early October. But they, like I said, they tend to blend in, so you have to know what you're looking for. And when they're ripe, they're rather soft, and they release from the tree quite easily, or they just fall down. But they bruise easily, too. So if you're picking one up from the ground, you should use it quite soon because it'll get kind of a bruisey taste otherwise, kind of an oxidized taste.
Mm-hmm.
And they're soft. If you can slice a pawpaw and it keeps its shape, then it's not ripe enough and it'll taste gross. But when they're ripe, they're a little soft and squishy. You don't want to eat the skins. The skins, they won't make you sick. They're just not delicious. The seeds are not edible. They can give you some digestive issues. So eschew the seeds. You can just slurp out the pulp, which has almost like a baby food like texture. Pawpaws are so fun to eat in the woods because you just become like this primate. You can connect with your inner primate and just make a big mess and then throw the skins to the side and you spit the seeds out. And you have this little flavor party out in the woods and then just keep moving on. But if you want to gather your pawpaws and take them back, you don't want to cram them into a backpack too much because they tend to bruise each other that way. Although I usually do just kind of gather up what I can and put them in bags. And once I get them home, you can refrigerate them for a couple days, but I like to process them as soon as possible. And that's just separating the pulp from the skin and seeds. And then I freeze the pulp. And once again, that's like baby food. Pawpaws don't take very well to heat. You can cook with them. And I do bake with them, and I do add them to cooked foods. But it tends to really mess up their volatile flavor compounds that make them taste the way they do. It just kind of mutes that brightness. And pawpaws have a little bit of a funky back note that's somewhat polarizing. But if you cook them, that back note moves a little more forward. So I wouldn't recommend canning pawpaws under most circumstances. I've had some pretty good pawpaw jams. I'd recommend adding pectin so you don't have to cook them as long. That's how they end up tasting good. But really the best way to preserve pawpaws, in my opinion, is to freeze them. Here in Ohio especially, craft brewers have been brewing beers with pawpaw, and that's another great way to put pawpaws to use, although oftentimes they source frozen pawpaw pulp. So yeah, it's true. The freezer, I think, is the way to go.
That's right. Over in Athens, there's a brewery that I know has made a pawpaw beer. My guest?
Yes,
yes. Yeah.
Jackie O's, and there's some other ones, too.
Well, I think it's called Little Fish.
Oh, yes. You know what? They're just wonderful, and they love to use foraged ingredients as well. So they have foraged. If you go to their brewery, they have different fruit plants growing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping to do a collaboration together. So in the fall, I'm going to go foraging for American persimmons, which are much smaller than the Asian persimmons you see at the grocery store. And I'm going to take them that pulp if I get enough, and they'll brew a beer with it. So they're definitely open to that kind of thing.
You're listening to the Book Nook. We'll be right back. My guest is Sarah Burr. Her book is The Fruit Forager's Companion. You just mentioned how you are out there in the woods with these pawpaws, and your inner primate comes out. And you attached yourself to my inner primate in your section on raspberries because I'm watching them. And right now, usually about the last 10 days of June up to the 4th of July is when the black raspberries are really ripe out here in southwest Ohio. And I have a lot of them growing wild in my yard. And it's a race between me and the daddy long legs. And I eat them right off the canes just like you do. It's like, well, do I put this in the container or do I eat it? I think I'll eat it. Well, I'll put this in the container. Okay, I'm going to eat this one. Right?
Yes, yes. I think there's something very powerful about, I call it the tasting room effect. If you've ever gone to a winery or a brewery and, you know, you taste all of their different wares, everything just seems to have this amazing flavor, and you're sitting there and they might be playing a certain music and have art up on the walls. So you're in this zone, and then maybe you buy that bottle of wine you thought was so great, and then you have it at home a couple months later and you're like, well, this isn't bad, but it's not what I remember. Sometimes I think that happens with fruit in a not negative way. The most powerful experience you can have consuming it is right there on the spot. You can hear the birds. and you're sweating a little bit because it's humid and there are these bugs around and everything's just so green, and you're probably a little bit thirsty because you've been tromping around and you have these just amazing, wonderful, hydrating black raspberries, which those really are the best. I mean, I won't thumb my nose up at red raspberries or blackberries, but man, black raspberries are there's something special.
I totally agree. And we have a we live out in the country, and there's a farmer across the road who's very fond of applying herbicides to his land. And I've noticed a lot of times the black raspberries along the road there get scorched by the drift of the herbicide. So I don't eat those anymore. But I'm telling you, I don't want to see anybody wading in, coming, being a forager like you, coming in and eating my wild raspberries. I'd run them off the property.
You know what? That's completely fair. But you did just bring up two very good points about foraging that people should keep in mind. Number one is, if you ever run across desirable, delicious plants, you should think, have these been sprayed with herbicides or pesticides? Oftentimes things on the side of the highway have been.
Mm-hmm.
So just wonder to yourself if they have been exposed to any chemicals that might not be that great for you. And also, who does this belong to? Is there some sort of transgression happening here? So one of the things I do, and you know what, it's totally true. If I'm walking, there's a very little traveled road that I take to get to one of my trailheads, and there are black raspberries on that road, and I eat those black raspberries, but I don't know whose land that is.
I want our listeners to know the scope of the fruit. So here we're talking about raspberries and we're talking about pawpaws, but the scope of this book, it's incredible. There's all these amazing photos, all this information about how to pick, what to pick, and then you've got this alphabetical list. Each chapter is for a different fruit. And I'm going to run down really fast so people know the scope of this. Apples, apricots, chokeberries, autumn olives, barberries, blackberries, blueberries, cherries, crabapples, cranberries, currants, elderberries, figs, gooseberries, grapes. We're only to the letter G. Ground cherries, hackberries, huckleberries, juniper, they're saying, lemons, limes, loquats, Oregon grape, mayhaws, mulberries, oranges, passion fruit, pawpaws, peaches, pears, persimmons, plums, pomegranates, prickly pears, quince, raspberries, rosehips, service berries, spice bush, strawberries, and sumac. I couldn't believe you could eat sumac.
Oh, yes. Well, that is one of the things that really throws people off because, of course, we think poison sumac when we hear sumac. Poison sumac is a different plant from sumac. So the sumac, poison sumac has white berries, and it grows in swampy areas. You're much, much more likely to run across here in Southeast or Southwest Ohio. Here in Southern Ohio, you're much more likely to run across staghorn sumac or scarlet sumac. And they are trees that are not super tall, but in the late summer, they have this russety colored bloom at the top. And that's actually full of all these little drupes. So they don't look like berries. These are our native sumacs. In the Middle East, there's a sumac, and those are more berry-like, and they crush it and use it as a spice. They dry the berries and crush it and use it as a spice. It's quite tart. This is not the kind of fruit you just eat standing on, you know, out in the woods. This is definitely something that you use by the sprinkling, you know, pinch as a seasoning. But you can also collect the heads that have all those little colorful, beautiful scarlet drupes on them, and infuse them in water, in cold water. They don't stand up to heat very well, so it's almost like making sun tea, but you can do it in the refrigerator. So you just put them in a pitcher of water and then pull them out and strain the water, and it turns this beautiful pale garnet color, and you can add a little sugar, or I use agave nectar to indulge my inner hippie, and it's a little bit, they call it sumac aid, and it's almost like an old chestnut of the foraging world. It's one of those recipes everyone kind of hears about before they hear about anything else. But it's so refreshing. That's probably my favorite way to use sumac, but I do make a spice blend with it, and I just shake it onto different roasted potatoes and vegetables. So you can do lots of different things with it. But the great news is that sumac isn't poisonous. Poison sumac is, and it's really hard to mix up the two unless you're a complete nincompoop, you know, which you know, try not to be one, I guess, listeners. Thank you.
The Native Americans drank that sumac beverage, right?
Yes, yes. And, you know, I imagine they probably didn't sweeten it unless maybe they had some some honey. You know, their palate was just a lot more attuned to bitter and sour flavors. And that's one of the things for me that I love so much about foraging. And I do include a lot of familiar fruits in there because those that's something that you're likely to run across. But to be using certain forage ingredients like sumac, or barberries, you really have to engage your brain and think about what the flavors are because it's almost like there's not a vocabulary for it. I used to be a music critic, and I noticed that when people talk about what one band sounds like, you end up talking about another band, like, oh, this sounds like Pavement and Velvet Underground. So, you know, I do the same thing. I just did it earlier with Pawpaws. You kind of have to come up with this common language for it. But sometimes if you're just experiencing something and you're not trying to communicate it verbally, you really have to stretch your brain a little bit and your expectations of what our own flavor vocabulary has become, which is, you know, basically a construct. So we kind of stick to the same flavors over and over again. And I think one thing that's great about the younger generation of people that's coming up is they're really hungry for new flavors and new experiences. So there's kind of this new crop of millennial foragers arising, and if you wanted to be a cynic, you could say it's because they just want to take pictures on Instagram and look cool because they found a plant.
Ouch.
But I think it's because they're just really hungry for honest new experiences. So I think that's something that's really exciting. You know, this stuff can bring people together. And like I said, it's not about looking cool. If you ever go to a festival where, like, there's a pop, I've gone to a couple different pawpaw festivals. There's a persimmon festival. When you go to places like that, it's just a bunch of plant nerds who are always really lovely people. But they're just so happy to be around other people who dig the same stuff. So anything that brings people together over a common interest that's constructive, I think, is a wonderful thing. And fruit will definitely do that. That's what everything is about in a way. It's like repetition and acknowledgement and honoring something. And that's actually what foraging is about, too. It's not just about I found this, I brought it back, and now I'm going to eat it. It's about looking and thinking and seeking. So that's what musicians are doing. They're always looking for these sound patterns that articulate an emotion that they want to express. And if you're foraging, you're looking for patterns in nature and recognizing them. And then what you do, you just seek those patterns out over and over again. And I think there's something really soothing about that. That's missing from our lives. So I try to go out on a walk every single day. Sometimes it's just a walk, like I walk my daughter to school. You know, that's just built into my day. I don't have to make that happen. But even on that short walk that's a couple blocks long, every day there's some tiny thing I notice that's new, and then there's something I notice that I've seen a million times. And just the cycles of that I find really grounding. And, you know, increasingly we don't have that kind of thing in our lives, so it's really important to make a place for that.
I love that parallel that you drew between enjoying music and enjoying the world of fruit or whatever. You know, I really like that song. I really like it when this tree is full of apples and it happens at this time of the year. And I actually remember as a little kid, I was a forager. I would go around the neighborhood and we had a lot of old semi-abandoned apple trees in people's yards. And they had all different kinds of apples on them. And we kids knew where they were and when they were ripe. And we would go into those yards and we would just feast, just gorge ourselves on these apples. One time I really wanted some ripe apples in this one yard, and I went over there, and then I noticed there was a nest of wasps underneath the apple tree. And I thought, well, these guys, they kept flying at me. I'm going to do something about it. So I found a little beach ball, and I put it on the hole that they were coming out of and stopped them. And I was really enjoying the apples. And then it was kind of like a horror movie. I looked over and I saw the beach ball rising up in the air. And suddenly my pants were full of these little stinging devils. And you describe an experience that you had that's similar to that.
Oh, yes, that does sound awful what you went through. Did you escape?
I ran home and my mother took my shorts off and I had all kinds of little bees in my pants.
Oh.
They were having a good time.
Oh, that's horrific. but yes, I did go through something a little bit similar. You know, every year I seem to get a mania for a different fruit. Actually, it happens to be the one that's the most in season at that moment. You know, these things have such short seasons oftentimes. So right now it's mulberries, and mm-hmm. before we began talking, I went out and I looked at my favorite trees, and they're kind of not doing it this year. But so my mulberry mania is a little bit on the wane. But last summer I had a black cherry mania. And when I say black cherries, I'm not talking about the ones you see at the grocery store. These are native trees, and the cherries are usually about the size of a large pea. Mm-hmm. And they're very, very tall trees. You oftentimes will notice them where, like, a woods and a meadow will meet. I don't think it's necessarily because that's their natural habitat. It's just that's the place a human is most likely to see them, right, is in these, like, border zones, because mm-hmm. that's the kind of place we're more likely to be than the middle of the woods. And in one of these border zones, there's a cemetery. So there's a clearing where all the people are buried and lawns mowed, and then there's the woods surrounding it, and there are just many black cherry trees. And last year was a great year for them. And I was really determined to go and gather up some. The best way to do that is to spread a tarp below the tree and to shake it. And then the cherries will just drop down because oftentimes they're too high out of reach. And they're very small. It's quite tedious to pick many. So unbeknownst to me, there was a yellow jacket nest below the tarp that I had laid out. So I got pretty stung up, and I retreated. And then, stupidly, I went back for the tarp. It was less than a quart of these things. I ended up having to go to the emergency room. So that was not a great scenario because, it wasn't fun. I feel badly for people who are allergic to this kind of thing. It really put me through the ringer. And not just the fear of it, but mm-hmm. your body has to recover. So anyway, that was kind of a debacle. So it did make me realize there's peril with doing anything. I don't want to make it sound like foraging is a dangerous activity, but sometimes it's not necessarily, is this plant poisonous? You have to think about other things. Might I twist my ankle reaching for this and mm-hmm. I'm in the middle of the woods? How would I get back? You know, just things like that. So I try to not get too swept up in my mania and use a little bit more reason than I'm apt to sometimes. I do a lot of foraging alone, but it's so great to go with people and to share that experience. So if anybody would like to get into foraging, my recommendation is to take a class or a workshop, or if you know somebody who is just one of those people who is really into plants and just is like one of those magic people who knows everything, go out in the woods with them and you'll learn so much. Even if you know a lot to begin with, just find a new person who's excited about this stuff. Find a plant nerd, and they will open up this whole other world. Like it's just amazing. So find that person if you can.
You do prepare yourself well. You have advice on everything from the containers to use for particular types of fruits to applying bug repellent if you're going out to a buggy area. It's just so full of advice, this book, The Fruit Forager's Companion, Ferments, Desserts, Main Dishes, and More from Your Neighborhood and Beyond. Sarah Burr wrote it. She joins us on the program today. And it was just so much fun to read, and I learned so much from this. Black cherries, I have those growing in my yard. I've never seen any fruit coming off of them. I'm going to have to check. When are they normally ripe?
That is in about August.
Really?
Usually. And
are they,
you know,
little tiny things that just fall off?
They are. They are. And they grow in these little clusters, not quite like grapes, but they do dangle down in clusters, unlike the cherries that we're used to seeing. So they're quite unusual. They're related to choke cherries, which I would think we tend to hear about more, but black cherries can be a lot sweeter. With foraged fruit, it's so different from tree to tree, the flavor. So if you ever find something, you taste it, and you think, that's not for me, I would recommend just trying it again from another tree. Just keep on trying it. You know, sometimes something truly isn't for you, but sometimes you just have a bad example. And that can happen with black cherries. What I'll do is if I've run across some, I just get a handful and I eat them. And if they're sweet and delicious, I'm super happy. And then you just spit out the seeds. It's so fun. And, you know, if they're not good, you spit out the whole thing.
Well, I can't wait to try those because I have them right in my yard. I had no idea. And another thing in my yard, I need to mention, you have all these sub-chapters where we're reading about those main fruits that I already read the list of. And then you have these other little areas where you talk about something that didn't deserve its own chapter. And one of them was May apples. I have hundreds of those in my yard. They bloomed a couple weeks ago, and now they have little fruits on them. I understand you've never been able to find one that was ripe.
Correct. In fact, just I can look out the window and see a May apple patch. I'm looking at it right now. Maybe after we get off the phone, I will go and check to see how they're doing. So yes, they have fruits, and they're very small. Usually, those fruits are not ripe in May. Mm-hmm. They might appear in May. But the fruits are not going to be ripe until later in June, probably. They start getting really wrinkly when they're ripe. And interestingly enough, they don't appear on plants unless they are forked. So they end up having two fronds instead of one.
Oh.
So I don't know exactly what they taste like. I've only read descriptions. But critters will get to these things, so turtles and raccoons. You don't want to eat a firm one. I've read that they can make you feel ill. So you want to wait until they're sort of yellow and wrinkly. And
don't eat the seed.
Correct. Okay, don't eat the seed. Okay. You know, with a lot of these forage things, there are these warnings, like don't eat this part and don't eat that part. And sometimes they're a little too played up, but I think it's always best to err on the side of caution unless a bona fide expert tells you otherwise. Just because, and you know, pretty uncommon that someone dies from plant poisoning or is sent to the hospital, but you also just don't want to feel kind of icky for an afternoon either, you know? Do your research. If you're curious about something, err on the side of caution. And I also recommend, you know, the internet is full of valid information and information that's not valid. So social media is really quite useful for some of this stuff. I'll take a picture and post it, and you know, people will leave comments. So sometimes I'll learn about things that way. But I've noticed sometimes people will comment and they leave incorrect information. So if you are trying to identify a plant by having people comment on it on social media, you know, that's just a tool. That's not a final word. If you know a person who knows what they're doing, maybe just text them that picture instead. And I usually cross-reference. I have a lot of field guides. The more you're into play, the more field guides you get. And I usually try to cross-reference at least a couple different ones. So I tend to make my identifications very slowly using quite a few sources. There are foraging apps, too. This is all getting a lot more advanced and handy as time goes by. I've not used a foraging app because I sometimes have my phone with me when I'm out so I can take photos, but I also like to not bring it because I tend to, I think it tethers me a little bit, you know? So it's a tool, but it's okay not to use it.
There's incorrect information on social media. I am shocked. This is the Book Nook. We'll be right back. My guest is Sarah Burr. The book is The Fruit Forager's Companion, you were saying?
I found out that there's incorrect information in reliable books as well. So one of the corrections I needed to make before the book went to print was about service berries, which we just finished the season up for that. Are you familiar with those?
I am not.
Okay, so that's a shrub. And I would say they get to be about, a big one can be about 10 feet tall. So they're like in that, they straddle the shrub tree category. And most people grow them as ornamentals. And early in June, in fact, Juneberry is another name for them, they have these tiny little berries about the size of blueberries. And they start out fuchsia. And once they're ripe, they're a bluish purple pink color, kind of hard to describe. And they do have a blueberry-like texture. They've got a couple seeds in there that you can spit out or eat. They taste amazing. They taste like a cross between grapes and blueberries. They're just terrific. I tend to call them service berries, but people call them shad berries or Saskatoon berries. It depends on where you're from. But the name service berry, I had read in quite a few places. The origins of that is that when the flowers would bloom, it would be around April, and that's when the ground had thawed, and you could bury people, and all the winter funerals that had been delayed were now happening. And so there were funeral services. The flower was an indication that it was a time to have these funerals, right? That's kind of a pleasing little story. But I was told that that's actually incorrect, and I haven't been able to look into the true origins of the name. So we had to correct that, but...
Yeah. I'm looking at the picture, and these do not look like anything I've ever seen, but I think I do recognize this chipmunk who is eating the service berry. I think I do know him. I think his name is Oscar.
He was probably eating some of your mulberries earlier, too.
My guest is Sarah Burr. We're talking about the Fruit Forager's Companion. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And I love this book. You've got some great blurbs in it. In fact, you have blurbs from a couple of people who have appeared on this program. Deborah Madison gave you a nice one, and so did Julie Zickafoos.
Oh, yeah. You know, she is Julie is one of those magic people to go out into the woods with, who opens these doors to hidden realms you didn't know about. She's just amazing. So I'm fortunate that she's part of my community. She's a lovely person.
And well, she's close by, isn't she?
She is.
Yeah.
She is.
Mm-hmm.
She lives in – she doesn't live in Marietta proper, but she's, like, way out in the woods.
Uh-huh.
So I do bump into her every now and then, which is quite a privilege. She's out and about so often, but she really does have a way of looking at things in a literal sense, but also as a worldview that I appreciate so much. She's a really special person to
she's
me.
Pretty amazing. I had a guest on last year who has a book out on your same publisher, Chelsea Green, and I'm thinking you might know him because you're kind of coming from the same place, Jeremy Zimmerman.
Yes, yes. You know, was he speaking about make mead for like a Viking?
Yep.
Ah, that is a really terrific book.
We had him on for that one. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And I think we're going to be speaking at an event, at the same event in Pennsylvania. So I look forward to meeting him. And what I really love about his book that I groove on quite a bit is this concept of it being okay to fudge things and to make mistakes and to learn from that and to not be quite so rigid with everything. So his approach to brewing is really quite liberating. He brings it back down to the people and empowers brewers to be creative and to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
So to embrace their brewing history, you know, literally just going back thousands and thousands of years, but also to incorporate things that have been filtered out of the process, just native plants and ingredients that have been forgotten, just because we sort of aged out of them as a society, I think. So
sure.
He just makes things new and exciting, and I definitely feel like my little foraging outings for fruit are kind of in that same vein. Yes, yes. So I'll have to listen to your conversation with him.
I did feel the commonality. This is a guy who lives in Kentucky, and he goes out in his yard, and he says, well, I think I'll pull some bark off that tree and put it in my mead.
Yes, he has a new book coming out called Brew Beer Like a Yeti. So that one is about the same philosophy but applied to beer, and I think we're really quite ready for that because the craft beer world has exploded so much, but it's also become a little bit preposterous.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of one-upmanship about, you know, how many hops can we cram into this, and his approach is at a time when it just makes things fun again, you know?
Now they've gone all fruity on the beer. It's just insane. They've all got fruit in them.
Yes, and you know what I think is fun about that is, you know, sometimes it ferments out enough that you get the fruity taste, but not so much of the sweetness, so that's not the case so much anymore. There's quite a lot more diversity both in the fruits that they're using and in the end flavor profiles. Mm. So, you know, sometimes things are gross, but people have different.
Yeah.
I love pawpaw beers myself, but I had a really good one from Little Fish. They do quite a lot of fruit beers. That's mm-hmm. one of their specialties. There was one called Momentary Freakout, and I had guava and another tropical fruit in it. But when you drank it, you didn't necessarily feel like you were having a fruit salad.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, Sarah, I'm a person who I ride my bicycle back and forth out through the countryside, and I have in my mind, I know that there's a wild plum tree over there, and I know that there's a pear tree down there, and I watch for them. This pear tree grows right along the road. I don't think it belongs to anybody, and it has some good pears on it. You have a great pear story in your book about this pear tree that didn't seem to be producing many pears, and then suddenly, boom.
Yes. It grew in a yard of a rental house we had, and it had never been properly pruned, or it hadn't been for years. So it just grew very high, and all the pears were out of reach. So the first year we lived there, it made one or two really hard pears that never ripened up. And the next year, it just went crazy. And I would have to wait, because we didn't have a ladder. I would have to wait until the pears dropped. Which is really not ideal. You want to pick them just shy of ripeness and let them ripen on the counter for the optimal pear experience. So these pears were ripening and falling down, and I'd go out and gather them and do all kinds of crazy things with them, and I still couldn't keep up. And it's not like I could just give them away to people because they were half mushy from the fall.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a real fun time, actually. I kind of missed those because I just made all kinds of ridiculous things. Feeling quite compelled that I needed to use as many as I could. And I kind of grew out of that feeling. Every now and then I'll get stuck in it. But now I definitely recommend to people, just because you have something doesn't mean you have to use it all. You're not going to save the world by using every single pear that you get from your yard. You know, it's okay. Just enjoy what makes sense. But you know what? I recall those pears tasting wonderful. And I don't know that I'll run across a pear tree that's quite the same. And it's not necessarily, you know, it's just this memory that I have now. So I'm glad you have a pear tree in your bike outings. And you know what? Foraging by bike is something I actually will do. I've noticed mm-hmm. when you're not on foot, you can still notice things. And sometimes in a different way, just because you're up higher, you tend to see things more differently. So I definitely will notice things in another way if I'm out riding my bike.
Well, they're little tiny pears, and there's nothing quite like, as you say in the book, biting into that pear that's perfect. And I've neglected to mention you have all these wonderful recipes, and I haven't actually talked about any of them. In your pear section, you've got a recipe. This is also a cookbook, folks, for arugula, pear, and almond pizza. That sounds good. You've also got Asian pear and roasted poblano salsa, pear butter. I've got to have that. And pear pie, pie. When we think about fruit, we think about pie, don't we?
Yes. And it took a lot of effort not to have the book full of pie recipes.
Mm.
Pies and jams tend to be the default preparation for weird fruits, I think, just because we all know what pies and jams are. Whereas to make, a spice blend or something is a little bit more esoteric. So I tried to include a range of recipes. They're not all sweet. You just named off two of the not sweet ones in the pear chapter. And I also have recipes for times when you have quite a lot of something. I have a recipe for apple cider, which is more of a procedure. It's just unfiltered fresh apple juice. That's what cider is. That's mm-hmm. all that fresh cider is. So if you can juice apples, you can make apple cider. Very messy, but something you can do once and taste like apple cider. It's kind of cool. You can make it yourself. So that if you have a lot of apples, you can do that. If you have three Asian pears, you can make the Asian pear salsa. Or if you just want a change of pace from pies. So there's so much you can do with fruit. It can be the star player. It can just add an accent to something that's really quite familiar, like pizza. Mm. So besides the recipes, I'm just hoping to introduce people to strategies for utilizing the fruit that they happen upon.
Okay, Sarah, you're living in Marietta, Ohio, and you've scoped out your area. You go out and you walk around, and you have your eyes out for various things. What do you have your eyes on right now? What's about ready to be ripe? What are you looking at?
Right now, I'm very much thinking about mulberries because there are some trees. They tend to not ripen all at the same time. So the later ripening mulberries, I can still go out and gather. I'm not totally sure that I'm going to, just because it keeps on raining, and I don't like to. I'll go foraging when it's raining, but you know, then everything's wet, and you kind of have to use it in a different timeline than you might otherwise. But I'm thinking about the mulberries; they're on my mind, and the things that will be coming up next will be raspberries and blackberries. Mm-hmm. So I'm keeping my eyes out on those, and you know, those brambles. It's like they appear out of nowhere. There's the power company mowed down one of my favorite spots, and it grew back up, and now I'm seeing the brambles come back up, so I'm keeping my eyes open for those.
You're talking about raspberries?
Raspberries and blackberries. Some of my favorite spots, they just both grow intertwined together. It's like a little fruit salad out there.
Blackberries have such terrible thorns. I've never been a fan of picking them.
Yeah, I can understand. And you know what? Oftentimes they are quite tart, I think, and not as juicy as I'd like them to be. But, you know, once again, it depends on the ones you run across. But if there are black raspberries nearby, they always pale in comparison.
Well, you don't.
So I'm looking out for those. And autumn olives will be ripening up later in the summer. So, it's a crazy looking shrub. They're an introduced plant. They don't look like olives. They're very small, and they'll be red when they're ripe. It's hard to describe. Mm. They have these weird silvery leaves, and they're a shrub that gets to be about, I don't know, maybe 10 feet tall to 4 feet tall. You often see them in meadows and on the roadside. So I'm scoping those out right now too. They're not going to be ready for a while, but I want to see how they're doing this year. Last year was bad. I'm always hoping that, you know, it's like this next year will be good. So I think this is going to be the year for those autumn olives.
I was not familiar with those either. What a fun book. What an adventurous book. It's The Fruit Forager's Companion, and it's pretty much about fruit. I'm wondering, do you go out and gather wild mushrooms and nuts? Do you gather other things too?
Mushrooms I do a little bit. If I saw morels, I'd be on them in a second. But I haven't found any, which is interesting because I just love maples as plants. I appreciate them. They're gorgeous little plants. It's cool to watch them come up, poke their heads up through the ground. And I've read that morels tend to grow near maples, but I have not verified that through my own experience, unfortunately. Mm. I'll get chanterelles. In fact, I think today would be, it's been pretty wet here, but warm, and it's always good to go after weather like that. Usually the next day or two, you can find a lot of those. Oyster mushrooms are another one. So those are pretty identifiable one, or hen of the woods. Mm. Those are the ones I'll get, but I don't have the same mania for mushrooms or other forageables that I have for fruit. I'm just really compelled toward fruit specifically.
Okay. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you about your book, Sarah.
Oh, my goodness. Vic, this has been such a wonderful time. I appreciate this conversation so much.
Good. Well, we had fun. My guest has been Sarah Burr, and the book is The Fruit Forager's Companion, Ferments, Desserts, Main Dishes, and More from Your Neighborhood and Beyond. It's a beautiful book published by Chelsea Green Publishing out of Vermont. Thanks for listening to the Book Nook for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.